Up next, from the Center for Social Innovation at Stanford, funders and grantees talk about working together to evaluate their programs.
On Social Innovation Conversations. Hi, I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
And I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation at the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're bringing you a new presentation in the Stanford Social Innovation Review Talks series. Stanford Social Innovation Review provides leaders in the nonprofit, government, and business sectors with the ideas, tools, and skills needed to solve social problems. For more information, visit us online at ssireview.org.
And now, here is our presentation in the Stanford Social Innovation Review Talk Series. So on behalf of the Center for Social Innovation, we're delighted to have you all here today. And for those of you that know, we're kind of fanatical at the center about breaking down boundaries. And we take that seriously to break down boundaries across sectors, to break down boundaries between theory and practice, and generally bringing groups of people together to problem solve that always don't come together in the same room. And so we've got a really diverse audience here today. We have foundation representatives. We have operating nonprofit representatives. We have consultant representatives. We have business representatives. And I think it's this type of environment and this type of audience that's going to be able to move these issues forward. And we have an equally diverse representation here with the panel who have all undergone successful evaluations. And one of the common things that they've done together is really new ways of working together. One of the challenges we have today with such a great panel is we have limited time. So I'm going to move things quickly, and I'm not going to go over their bios that are all in your program. I can tell by the titles you all have that you can read. So I'm going to leave that to you to kind of look at all their vast experience that brings them here today. What I'm going to touch base on, though, is a little bit of why did we invite them here, and touch a little bit on their organizations, because I think one of the important things is they all have different missions. They're all with different organizations that are serving different needs. They've all approached evaluation differently, but they have all been successful. And I think by the end of the panel, you will also see some common threads that led to their success that hopefully we're going to try to highlight through the panel today. So our first panelist is Esther Kim, and Esther is the portfolio manager for Rediff. Rediff is a venture philanthropy fund that supports social enterprise organizations that try to transition low-income and disadvantaged populations through work and employment and running businesses. And so as a venture fund, they do investments, they do capacity building, they do networking support. And one of the things that Esther is going to be talking about, Rediff is known, and I will give a little background, as in a previous life, I was with one of the organizations that was a Rediff grantee, so I feel like I could be on CNN, like, keeping them honest. So if, you know, I don't agree with something, I'll make sure that gets brought to the forefront. But one of the things I think that Rediff has done that you'll see today is, as a funder, they were able to work across their grant portfolio to bring evaluation forward, and they've made a big investment both financially and of time that have really led to some great outcomes, I think, both for the funder as well as the grantee. So again, we've got the funder perspective with Esther. Our next evaluation model, we actually have two representatives here. We have Jamie Bedini, who is a research manager at the University of Washington School of Social Work. And then next to her is Sandy Lowe, who is vice president of community services for family services up in Seattle, Washington. And what they're going to be talking about today is the work that they did through the Sound Family Initiative that was initiated and funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So in this particular case, one, we have the family service organization, which I found fascinating when I looked at, was funded in 1892. So here you have this large, comprehensive community service organization that's been around for a while. They deal with domestic violence, homelessness, a variety of issues. You know, how did they move the evaluation needle in this larger initiative that was by the Gates Foundation? And so I think it's nice we have Jamie here, who was the evaluator. So she had to play this role between the Gates Foundation and multiple grantees. And then we've got Sandy's perspective of how did that work from a grantee perspective. And again, in this instant, it was very successful, but we'll be able to kind of pull, you know, what they learned from that. And our closing panelist is J.B. Schramm, who is the CEO of College Summit. And College Summit is a nonprofit organization that works in partnership with schools, school districts, and colleges to increase college enrollment of low-income and disadvantaged young people. And one of the things with J.B. Schramm's model is their success is dependent on their partners. And J.B., again, in kind of the field, is well known for working well with his funders and really as the organization driving the evaluation. They drove the model, they drove the metrics, and kind of pushed that model up to their funders and their various constituencies in a very kind of successful manner where their partners have to get on board as well as their funders. So again, now, you know, closing it, we'll have this grantee perspective of how they moved evaluation forward. So again, you know, throughout the day, later this afternoon, you're going to be hearing from academics. We had Mark this morning. You know, what we hope this panel brings to the day is kind of the hands-on experience. What is it like to move these initiatives forward when you're working in the trenches here? So what we hope you take away from the panel are kind of, you know, four broad things. One is a deeper understanding of these successful evaluations, that you can look at them and evaluate, could this be relevant to what I'm doing? And what we've really want to focus on are what were the key drivers and what were the key lessons learned? You know, looking at the past, what happened, and then the third thing is, what does that mean going forward? This is an ongoing process. We keep learning, and so also what we're going to be teasing and talking about is, what does this look like in the future? And then, you know, the end piece, though, is throughout this conference, for this panel, how do you make evaluation helpful for mission delivery and not a burden that hinders your mission and goals of your organization? So again, I'm going to now turn it over to Esther, and we'll get going on that. I knew I'd forget something. So how we've set it up that each person's going to talk for about 10 minutes, and then we will open it up at the end for Q&A.
Great. Thank you, Chris, and thank you to FSG and SSIR for having all of us here to talk about our evaluation approaches. It's great that the field, both on the funder side and on the nonprofit side, you can see the response here today, the interest in trying to improve evaluation approaches. And REDF has very much been on the forefront of that from the very beginning. So I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about what our philosophy was and our approach around measurement over the past 10 years, and specifically a couple of things that we are thinking about doing differently based on what we've learned over the past 10 years. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about what REDF is and what we do and who we work with as context for describing what it is that we measure and why. So REDF is a nonprofit intermediary that funds a set of Bay Area social enterprises. So nonprofits that run businesses to employ disadvantaged people. And really the focus is on the employment and on those disadvantaged people to help move them towards self-sufficiency through the employment. And we've been doing this for the past 10 years. We started off as a part of a foundation. Now we are an intermediary, and I'll tell you in a bit how that actually has changed and shaped how we think about measurement, because now we also have to fundraise in addition to being a grant maker. So we're kind of in that middle space, and that's taught us a couple of things about how we approach evaluation as well. In addition to funding these organizations, and you'll see that we had funded the organizations on the left, this is some of the examples of who was in our portfolio up to 2006, we had worked with those organizations for a number of years, and what I'll describe is the history of the approach we use to measure the impact of the organizations and those social enterprises on the people that they worked with. But I'll also talk about the new portfolio, so the organizations on the right, who we have started working with in 2007. We decided, as part of a new strategic approach, to work with a new set of organizations and realized that this was a great opportunity to sort of recast our measurement approach. So I'll talk about both our approach with our original portfolio and then what the lessons learned from that will apply to how we approach measurement with the new portfolio. And how we work with our portfolio is basically, in addition to unrestricted funding, we work with them long-term. So with some of the original organizations, we actually work with them for 10 years. So long-term engagement, we're now aiming for more like 3 to 5 years with the new portfolio. We actually set goals both on capacity building as well as the target number of job opportunities that we want to create with the portfolio by the time we finish engaging with them. And that, I think, has really helped shape the direction that we focus on for the portfolio's work together. Each organization, we set these goals, and then we track how we're achieving these goals, both from the capacity building side and from the job opportunities and what that affects the people that are being employed in those jobs. We work really closely with these organizations. It's quite an intense relationship. We meet with them monthly. We bring in all sorts of guidance based on the goals that we have. We have an MBA intern and fellow program, which helps to bring in capacity as well as building leaders in the nonprofit sector through this program. And then one key element, of course, is measurement. We place great emphasis on measurement of social and financial outcomes of these businesses, as well as of the people that are employed in the businesses. This is informed by the fact that we started off, really, the approach of REDF was kind of the venture capital model, and people call us a venture philanthropy. That approach was really, in the private sector, looking at what's the return on the investment that I'm making into a business. So we started off looking at, well, what's the social return on the investment that we're making in our portfolio. But as you'll see in the next slide, that we have evolved our thinking and what we mean to invest in an organization and to work together. So this is a little history of our approach over time, and I'll describe some of the things that we did and why we did them. I don't know if you're familiar with this term, social return on investment, but that was one of the things that REDF is known for and has still known for, but in fact, we're actually not using anymore, and I'll tell you why. Social return on investment, the notion of it was really to get, and this was, I think, something that was new in the field at the time, to try to quantify the return or the value of what social benefit, as well as the financial return of or cost of the businesses that are employing the people that we work with. So this methodology that we came up with, I think, really changed people's thinking about, well, we could actually try to figure out or quantify what the social impact is of what we're doing. And so this really pushed people's thinking, and it actually, the portion of it that was tracking the impact of the people that are employed in the enterprises over time is something that actually has stayed with us to today. So that's what the top line is, RISE, which stands for Real Indicators of Success in Employment. that actually fed into both SROI and then OASIS, which I'll describe in a minute. That was basically our approach to tracking the social outcomes of the people, which was we actually engaged an evaluation consultant to help us to interview at the start of employment and then every 6 months for 2 years, every single employee that was ever employed in a Red F social enterprise. And so we, since we've been doing this up till now, we have over 10 years worth of great sort of longitudinal data on the employees and kind of what happened to them over time, and specifically in seven areas, including employment status, housing, wage increase, income increase, as well as some other more qualitative indicators. So we have done this, we're still doing this, but there's something there that we realized we could learn from, which is A, it's a lot of data, and what do we do with it? You know, one of the things that we did do with it was publish what happened to these people and saw that, wow, things are really improving for these individuals over time. But what we hadn't done was, okay, so how does that compare to other people? How does that compare to other interventions and other ways in which people are being helped other than social enterprise? Because our question, our original question was, does social enterprise work as an approach? After 10 years, we think the answer is unequivocally yes, because we have had great results for the people over time, including the fact that over 80% of the people who we interviewed at the two-year follow-up are still employed or are still in school after 2 years. And these are people that are chronically either disabled or unemployed or have a history of homelessness, at-risk youth. So pretty impressive outcomes. But the thing was, we also realized, and the portfolio came to us and said, you know what? You're asking for all of these things, and we have other reporting requirements to other funders. We have lots of other things that we want to know. And so we actually would like a way to sort of organize this information to have it be more about performance management than just evaluation. And so that's where OASIS came in. And OASIS stands for Ongoing Assessment of Social Impacts. And keep in mind, this was back in 99-2000. We actually decided to help the organizations to build a performance management system, a social metric information system, in other words, because we wanted to put our money where our mouth was, and we wanted to not be that funder that just comes in and asks for a lot of evaluative data without investing in the organizations to be able to collect it. So what we did was we got help from other funders, we got help from our evaluation consultant, and we also had help from a technology consultant firm to actually build from scratch an information system that would both track, collect, and be able to report both inputs and outcomes for of interest for the portfolio organizations. This was, I believe, a two-year-long process. It was rather expensive, but at the time, there was nothing else out there that did this. So what we felt that it did do was build the organization's capacity to measure their thinking around measurement change so that it wasn't just report to the funder, but what Mark was talking about, more real-time data and information to better manage their own programs. And we learned a lot about having it be just as much what do the organizations need to improve and succeed and get better data and thinking about data, as well as what we needed to know about how successful is social enterprise as an approach, how well do the people that we are serving do over time. So while the SROI changed the field's thinking about quantifying social benefit, OASIS, I think, really pushed the envelope in terms of, using evaluation and investing in evaluation as performance management and not just evaluation. And so we are doing all of these things now and thinking about what we've learned and what were the issues with each of these things that we did with our portfolio, and thinking ahead to our new portfolio organizations, what can we do better? So with SROI, the real issue there was that it was a lot of information and it was hard to calculate. The metric was a bit opaque. Even today, if I were to try to say exactly what is calculated in SROI, it would be kind of tricky and difficult to explain. So that's kind of rule number one for a metric. It needs to be simple and easy to understand. The other thing was that it focused on the benefit to society, which we thought investors cared about. But what we really cared about was how are the individuals doing over time. And so we realized that we needed to recast what we measured, focusing on the individual rather than on society. With OASIS, we learned that, you know, that we could provide capacity building to help the organizations, but that it was expensive and actually hard to maintain something that you build custom over time. We're not a software firm, neither are nonprofits, and so we needed to have something that was a little bit more sustainable. The other thing was that OASIS tracks, with some organizations, everything. And so what do you do with all this data? What does it tell you? And how do you actually learn from it? And if you have too much data, it's hard to figure out from all that data what's the key message. What is it that you actually want to try to change? So that was the lesson from OASIS. And then with the tracking of these outcomes through RISE, which we are still doing, we realized we didn't actually know, or it was hard to look and say, well, how are we doing compared to other interventions for the same populations? And what's the relative cost effectiveness of this approach versus other interventions? So all of these things that we did, that we at the time, we didn't know if anybody else was doing it, or we didn't think anybody else was doing it, we're now learning from it and trying to shape how we work with our new portfolio. Because I want to talk about what it is that we're going to change or we're thinking about changing. And this is all still a work in progress, but we were really trying to be thoughtful about how we take the lessons learned from our measurement approach to our new portfolio. So it really is about, first, what do we measure? So can we think about being more comparable to other organizations or to other approaches? Can we think about looking at our past data, the 10 years worth of data that we have, and we're now doing this, looking back and saying, how do we make subpopulations within our portfolio data look like, say, what the Workforce Investment Act cares about in terms of their populations? And then how do you compare that data to then, this is the next step, be advocates for our portfolio and for other social enterprises that are serving the same populations? How do we then take what we've learned and go to the workforce investment boards? How do we go to the federal, state, and local government funders and policymakers and say, you know, the way that your policy is currently shaped, it's actually not focusing on the hardest to serve. It's not proportionately funded towards the most cost-effective approaches. We believe that we already have the data and that we will collect better data because we'll ask the right questions so that we can make a better case to other funders, to policymakers. One example would be the Office of Community Services. They made a very large capital grant to one of our portfolio organizations to start their new business. Meanwhile, they wanted to track, they only counted full-time jobs, whereas they're trying to serve formerly homeless individuals for whom full-time jobs may not either be appropriate or the best intervention. So what's the outcome that this funding is trying to achieve versus what is actually doable at the ground level? So we're trying to take the information that we're collecting and make a better case for funding. And then finally, we're also re-looking at how we measure this information to be less burdensome to the portfolio, to really help leave them in a better place with more sustainable systems as well as results, and give them better real-time information. So we're looking at commercial software, we're looking at giving them grants so that they can customize to what they need, while at the same time also giving access to information that we need. And then finally, we really are key to this, that we want to leave the organization stronger than when we left, than when we started. So it helps us to then sustain the outcomes that we know are good long term, long beyond our engagement with the portfolio.
Great. Thanks, Esther. Okay, now I'll turn it over to Jamie, and I think yours is already on.
Okay, I'm just checking. So I was asked to start with just a brief overview of the Sound Families Initiative. And it was a 7-year, $40 million investment by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to create service-enriched housing for homeless families in 3 counties of the Puget Sound region. That $40 million included monies for capital and services, as well as about $100,000 to $200,000 each year for the evaluation, which kind of translated into, in addition to all the activities we did, about 3 full-time staff, including myself. Our evaluation team from the University of Washington School of Social Work was involved from the outset in determining the outcomes and designing the evaluation questions and engaging stakeholders at all levels from the very beginning. And when I say stakeholders, I mean your senior agency officials, program directors, case managers, members of the community who may not have been directly involved with the initiative. Our design, just very briefly, included basic data collection on every family who entered and exited a transitional housing program, and there were about 40 programs by the time we closed down the evaluation, as well as 10 case study sites. We'd selected 10 programs from whom we drew 200 families that we interviewed during their time in the programs and 6 months, 1 year, 2 year, and 3 years post-exit. We also collected data on system and organizational level outcomes, which I'll talk about a little bit in a minute. And that was primarily through interview processes, again, with a broad array of stakeholders. Some of the key milestones, when I was trying to think about what those were, I actually anchored them to the reports. And not because our reports were so important, but I think that they coalesced into an understanding of what was needed at each of those time points in terms of producing timely and meaning, and most importantly for us, that meaningful and useful feedback back to the programs, practitioners, and the leadership of the initiative itself, so that there really could be a focus on using what we knew at each time point, not waiting for the 5 years longitudinal data, but using the data as we were learning and gaining an understanding of what was going on in the field to really inform decision making. And again, inform decision making at the agency level, which Sandy will talk about in a couple of minutes, all the way up to leadership of the initiative. And that would be primarily through the governing body of the steering committee. So one of our early reports, we called it preliminary findings. It was really too early to talk about families. Virtually none of them had left programs at that point, but everyone wanted to hear some data. And so we focused on what we were learning about the implementation of the initiative. What was working, what wasn't working, what were some of the barriers for the providers and grantees out there? What helped make effective partnerships? A lot of these programs were actually service and housing providers coming together. Often there were multiple service providers or a property manager that was external to those groups as well. So some complicated programs, and we wanted to understand what was working there in those partnerships, what wasn't. What were some of the organizational capacity issues that got in the way of serving families well or even just implementing this new model in many cases? And then we moved on to something we called the Midpoint Report, which was before our midpoint, but it was the first release of our case study families. So this is where we got to talk about what we were learning about the families who are being served in these programs. And that raised lots of issues, especially at the steering committee level, about who was getting served and, you know, why this group, who wasn't being served, and what did we know about this group of homeless families. This is where I really think that we took on a powerful role as a bridge between the field and some of the leadership in terms of educating around complex social problems that lead to family homelessness. Then we had a bit of a departure, and we did put together two reports that were nowhere on our radar screen in the design process. But there were a couple of issue areas that were emerging that we really wanted to shine a light on, and we wanted to get some dialogue going around. We knew they were important to the field, and so we felt like it should be something that was talked about, again, at that leadership level for the initiative. And those two reports were kind of titled Early Exits, so it was about the 20 to 25% of families who were being evicted or asked to leave from these programs. So this was a very open way of talking about the failure and the failures of the initiative, and felt like a big risk for a lot of folks. But once we got to that point, it turned out to be just an amazing tool to really understand, again, who the model was working the best for and who it wasn't, and then that future question of what do we do with the families for whom it's not working, and that informed the foundation's decisions in terms of future planning. We also did a focus report on children's issues. We knew we didn't have a lot of data on kids. We knew we needed to be talking about them more. We needed to talk about intergenerational homelessness more. So we pulled together what we had. We did additional case manager and children's advocate interviews, and just, again, trying to put together a document that would move discussion, dialogue forward. A couple other reports we did were around the follow-up data. So the longitudinal data started rolling in. And those reports, including the final summary of the final findings, enabled the discussion to move to really focus in on the families and also what we, as the entire initiative, wanted for these families. And I say that because we definitely saw lots of gains in income and employment, stability, but there are also plateaus. And we also started to become clear, or there was a clear understanding that in some ways we were stabilizing families, but we were stabilizing them into poverty. And was that enough? Is that where we wanted to stop? Is that what we really wanted? We'd achieved all these goals. We could check off the list, but were people happy? And the timely, meaningful reporting to drive dialogue, change, and decision-making, not just, you know, here's a report, sit on your desk and see what we've accomplished. So several keys of the approach that we took, I've got on this slide, just trying to boil it down to what were a few of the things that we thought were effective. And I want to add that even though this was a fairly large-scale evaluation, we had a lot of resources to work with. All of these approaches and principles can be used on a much, much smaller scale. And most of the evaluations that my team does are much smaller scale than Sound Families, and we adhere to as many of these principles as we can. In some cases, it's actually easier to adhere to the principles when you're working on a smaller scale evaluation, too, particularly around the participatory part of it. So of the keys, that there was an intentional focus on outcomes at the three levels from the beginning. So it was expected that we would be out collecting system and organizational level information, again, to primarily drive an understanding of the implementation, where some of the barriers were, what were some of the larger issues that were impinging upon the ability of programs or agencies to be effective. The overall goal of the evaluation was definitely to inform implementations. I think I've talked about that a bit already. And our evaluation team was integrated into the initiative. I think there was a question earlier today that I think that this answers in part in terms of how do you have that good communication? How do you help influence decision making? And it very much came down to my role as manager, which was, again, not really a role I'd expected early on, but that I was very involved on the steering committees, the review committee that reviewed grant applications. I was in regular communication with the director of the initiative, the program officer at the foundation. You know, I was hearing what their questions were and thinking about what data we had that could help answer those questions, as well as what data we might be able to collect in addition to what we were doing that would help answer those questions, and vice versa. I knew what some of the concerns were in the field and what some of the successes that should be shared were. And so very much being that bridge between the funders and funders and leadership and the field were important. There was definitely an overall culture of expectation that this evaluation was about learning and improving. It wasn't about determining who's doing the best work out there, who has the lowest eviction rate and the best outcomes. It was about learning from the ground up. And then we definitely had ample time and resources. And again, the scale of this, you can create ample time and resources in a smaller scale evaluation as well. But making sure that you have time to engage everybody you can at that early design phase so that you're not just asking questions. You know, as a university person, we're not just asking questions that we're interested in learning the answers to. And it's not just what the funders wanted to learn, but it's both of those as well as what do agency directors want to learn? What do case managers want to learn that will help them improve their practice? Those are very critical, and they're critical to do up front. Once you've got some of that buy-in and engagement early on, everything else is easier. Also, the time and resources for good qualitative data. So interviewing takes longer, but how important it is to understand what is behind the numbers, the hows and the whys, the things that aren't showing up in the quantitative data. And then feedback loops, which I haven't talked about too much here, but we were regularly providing kind of data briefs, so non-narrative reports, but just getting data back into the hands of each agency. Every agency got their own data back twice a year, once a year if you were a big case study program, because that was a lot to deal with. But, you know, these were very early findings. Some of these ends were very small, and we talked a lot about the qualitative data. But we felt that it was important to sit down with agency staff and say, here's what we're hearing from your clients and your former clients. Here's what we're making of it. What do you make of it? What's missing? Tell us what the context of this is. And we took all of those meetings and all the feedback we got, and we're able to roll that into our understanding that we carried forth to the steering committee and to the foundation.
Family Services, as Chris said, is a 116 years old agency, and we, we had never and still don't own anything. So we did not have housing, but we were very interested in serving a homeless population and had been doing that for a number of years, and wanted to develop partnerships in the community with housers so that we could pair up our services. When the Sound Families Initiative came along, which was a funder saying, here's what we would like, which was a partnership between a service provider and a housing provider, it was truly a marriage made in heaven, and we were ready to jump right in. And the evaluation process of the Sound Families Initiative was part and parcel and integral to the process from even before we submitted an application. In pre-application conversations, that was clear. And I think that starts with some of the ways that this was successful. As Jamie was saying, and as you've heard in some of the other things, the participatory nature of this is just really crucial. And we really, I think, part of the reason that for us, from the program assistant who enters data to the case manager who helped collect it, to supervisors and staff who looked and tried to understand it, as well as our senior management at the agency, really needed to have that participatory part of it. We have questions ourselves. We wanted to know. We want to use data to create a learning environment in our agency. As a family service agency, you know, we always say we look at the root causes, not just the surface. And the only way to really look at a root cause, even internally, is to understand. And the data was a means of doing that. I think that culture of learning was inherent in having the evaluation be part and parcel of the practice and what we were doing. And when Jamie was just now reflecting on the reporting process, that was just so critical to our ability to do what you've all talked about here in the performance management end of things. Just as Jamie had a very integral role in helping the steering committee shift to look at some more direct changes, we were able internally to make some smaller shifts in the way that we manage things. We went on from this original project to grow into going from supporting 15 units of housing to now we're supporting 78 units of housing. And the information that we've learned and been able to have access to has really informed our practice. I think another critical point, there were sort of three things I wanted to highlight, and that was, while evaluation was clearly the an integral part of the process, and it became, as one of my staff members said, as important, she said one day, evaluation is as important as the case management. And we're all like, yes. So it was a great ability to be able to do that. But at the same time that we really had staff who appreciated the role of evaluation, we all know it's hard to collect data, especially when you're the frontline staff and you're seeing the family and the evaluator's seeing the data. So the evaluator's data are our clients, and how that can play out, I think there's a certain tension that can go when that in that arena. And by and large, we didn't have a lot of that because the data, one, was what we wanted to know, was answering questions. And number two, the staff, the evaluation staff, really saw the families as families. They really knew that family lives are messy. They don't always adhere to the exact strict protocol that you would like to have, that we all would like to have. And yet you still need to find out what's going on. And there was a very great ability to have this interplay of understanding what it was like on the ground, as well as somewhat trying on our side to understand what was needed so that that you could actually make sense of this data and that there would be some clean data. So it was a very conscious effort on both parts, and I think that made a tremendous difference. And as part of that, the last thing is there was always a feeling of we're all on the same team. We're all really interested in helping families who have been homeless for a long time become housed, move ahead, and change a real critical problem in our community. And the reports that Jamie talked about with the children and the what's wrong, all were really part of being on the same team and helped us tremendously, because often we do learn by what's missing, what isn't there. There wasn't a lot of information about the children, and yet the case managers were coming back with a lot of things that were happening in the children's life that would then take a family that seemed to be just fine and maybe lead them to eviction because that issue wasn't being looked at. The same thing with other things about why families were needing to exit early or leave. By looking at that and really admitting that, and it wasn't it wasn't that report card of you did well or you did badly. It was, this is what happened, what does it mean? And integrating that. So it was, from our perspective, extremely, has been successful, and also was capacity building. We now have our own director of evaluation. We're trying to carry on some of these things as we move ahead, and we really have appreciated that opportunity. So I'm the client story, and it was a successful client story.
So I think then, Jamie, you were going to just talk about, again, what were the key principles that could be implemented, just real briefly? The participatory,
yeah,
or you already
touched
on those. Okay.
Really just everything up there.
So I'd rather save the time for questions.
Okay, yeah. Great. Okay, so next is JB. So
thanks, ahead. Chris. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. What I think could be helpful is if I describe how we use at College Summit evaluation data to do our work day to day. And what I'll do is I'll spend 1 minute describing what our work is so you have context. And then I'll tell a story of how we work with a partner using evaluation data. Then I'll describe how thinking about evaluation has evolved over time for us. And then finally, a couple lessons that we've learned. What our work is we help high schools and school districts raise their college enrollment rates school-wide and build the kind of college culture that helps students stay on track academically and graduate college ready. We work with 200 high schools in 12 states. They graduate 17,000 students annually and serve 80,000 students. We're working with every student in St. Louis with Gates support. We'll soon be in 100 high schools in New York City. We work with 20% of all students in the state of West Virginia. And thanks to the Irvine Foundation that invited us to start work in California a few years ago, and the good folks at Corette and Salesforce, we're doing work now with 2,600 seniors in high schools that have 13,000 students in the Bay Area, mainly in Oakland, as well as in LAUSD and Inglewood in Southern California. One way to think about what college-going culture is, it's how you make the reward of college and career real in a high school. And some of you have probably read the Bridgeland Peter Hart survey of dropouts that found that the number one reason that students who dropped out gave for having dropped out was that high school wasn't relevant. And in particular, they didn't experience high school as relevant for their job and career goals. So the way we help high schools build college-going culture to address that is we do four things. One is we help them provide a post-secondary education planning course for all students. So we provide curriculum and online tools for that. Second is we train teachers, counselors, and principals on how to be college positive and college savvy. Third, we help them find the most influential students in the school who then get trained to be guerrilla marketers of college-going culture in the school. And then lastly, we provide measurement tools. Outcome measurement, college enrollment, persistence, graduation data, as well as leading indicator data so that they can spot when a student or a classroom is going off track. In terms of results, over the last 2 years, our high schools have been closing the achievement gap in college-going rates between low-income students and middle-income students by 50%. In terms of persistence, these low-income students have been persisting in college at the above the rate of low-income students and actually at the same rate of students from all economic backgrounds. So that's a bit about the work College Summit does. Here's a story. So when we work with high schools and school districts, often we're trying to help them change some practices, especially with high schools that are struggling. And we have a few different persuasive tools we can use. We can help a principal see a vision. We can share best practices models. Sometimes we can get the superintendent to, you know, have a little bit of a heavy hand, which has its own costs. But probably the most effective way that we found is to use data to help the principals self-organize around their own solutions. So if you could turn on the slide. So this is from I'm going to show you just two slides that we took to a meeting with the superintendent in Kanawha County, West Virginia. That's the largest district in the state with 10% of the state's population. He was there along with seven of his principals. So he first showed this slide, which is the good news slide. This is data from the West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission. So it's state data on in-state college enrollment. And what you can see is the top line is the line for Kanawha County, the district we were working with, and the lower line is the state minus the Kanawha County data. In 2002, the state started a ambitious college scholarship program modeled after the Hope Scholarships in Georgia that you may have heard about. And not surprisingly, the enrollment rate for the state and for Kanawha County goes up. Then in 2004, in their inestimable wisdom, the legislature decided that the scholarship program was too successful. They couldn't afford it. So they decided to raise the eligibility requirements. This is what we have a hedge fund guy on our board, and he said, wait, so in my business, when you invest and you get the results you want, you put more money into it. But Well, not surprisingly, the enrollment rate starts going down at that point for the state. Coincidentally, 2004 was the year that we started working in all of Kanawha County's high schools. And you can see that Kanawha County then bucked the trend of the state by 11%. So this is the outcome data we worked with. The superintendent said, quietly, he said, "This is the kind of data that makes me do my superintendent happy dance." So then we turn to the next slide, which is leading indicator data. So every 4 to 6 weeks, we share with our partner high schools, all 200 of them, leading indicators based on how students are progressing in the post-secondary transition process. This data is on applications out the door as of January 15th. You can see there's some variation between the different high schools. Within 2 minutes of the data being out there in the room, principal, it was Paula Potter from Riverside High School, turned to Bill Walton from South Charleston and said, "You know, what are you doing that we're not doing?" And he had three ideas for. And those conversations started among the principals. And that's so much more effective and efficient than me, or than I, or whatever, I or me, telling them what they should be doing. So data can be very powerful if presented in an empowering way to help partners self-organize around solutions. The way evaluation has evolved for us over the years, at our very first board meeting, December 19th, 1996. We're about 101 years. They're 101 years older than we are. The question that we tackled in our first board meeting was, what was our metric going to be? And we concluded that it was going to be college enrollment rate community-wide. And then that college persistence and retention would be our quality control metric. So that's how we started, and we measured enrollment rates from that point on. For the first years, we did it by surveying students, which gets you modestly accurate data. Then the National Student Clearinghouse, which is a phenomenal database created by the student loan industry, which has data on 91% of college seats in the country, started making their data available. So finally, we could actually inexpensively, like a couple dollars a student, get actual data from college registrars from around the country. And so that made it much more possible to get accurate data. And so we're doing that. We also augment that with data from states, for instance, from the state of West Virginia's database. And the state of West Virginia is actually now doing an independent evaluation of us with some of the data that we saw there as a part of it. And then tying that in with leading indicator data. So we have data that our sites collect on schools on how the students are progressing in terms of inputs along the process. And Deloitte is now building for us a data warehouse so that we can do analytics connecting outcome data with the leading indicators in a much more powerful way to help our superintendents and principals and teachers see what's going on. And to Mark's point about the Annie Casey example, where it was, you know, getting the participants to gather up data, something that we're starting to work on now, which I think is very promising, is getting the students themselves to be viewing the comparison data from classroom to classroom. So getting them to be involved in assessing management data. So that's a bit of how we've done evaluation. Here's a couple lessons. Probably the one thing that we did that was smartest was start our organization by picking our metric. I can't tell you the number of times that decision has kept us on track as we've had to make choices over the years. And now, second, and this is an issue that we struggled with, which is around getting principals to engage with data. Early on, our high school principals were resistant. And at first, we blamed them. We said, you know, they're not interested in data. But that wasn't it, actually. It's that we had not gotten the data to them in a way they could use it. One of my favorite lines from a superintendent is, you're like, data, 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 and nothing to help me think. So one of the key elements is providing not just data, but analysis. So in each of these times we come to them with our monthly data, it's also with some analysis comparing their school with similar schools and what's working better here and there. It's also getting them leading indicator data. people running schools are much more interested when they've got something that can help them fix something now before the student's gone and it's too late. And then finally, another lesson is about aligning data, or aligning which data you choose to focus on with your different partners. I've been in dozens of superintendents' offices where I've been saying, we can help you raise your school-wide, district-wide college enrollment rates. And they say, I care about what my students are going to do when they leave, but nobody is measuring it, so it's not a priority for me. So part of our work has had to be educating districts on measuring college enrollment and persistence and graduation rates. We've been doing some work on Capitol Hill so that high schools could actually get their college enrollment data and persistence data regularly. But there's been that question of getting the metrics aligned in with our school partners. Similarly, on the funder front, there's a couple of issues. One is it's important to help funders distinguish between college going rates from small group programs, where you've got some potential student selection bias going on. Bob Shireman, who used to be at Irvine, did a nice paper on how basically all college access programs that are small group send 90% of their students to college. And with small group, that's a different way of looking at data versus when you're talking school-wide data. And then the point that Mark referred to, and this is my last one, which is about getting alignment with investors and with staff around what outcomes you're going to measure. So we created a four-year plan 4 years ago where we set four major goals. And we went out and got 10 investors to put in $15 million against this plan. So not against a project, but against our overall organization plan, and in particular just against our hitting those four metrics in 4 years. So it's given us enormous amount of freedom over this time to change staffing, change job models, change products, because no one's saying, well, we funded you to create that product. That's what we're going to hold you accountable for. The funding is tied to hitting our student outcome numbers in the end. And then some other funders, and Christy Chin's here. I saw her when she was at Skoll. Skoll, who wasn't a part of the original investor group for this four-year plan, gave us a significant grant and said, you know what, we'll just use that same reporting mechanism. And we've had a few others follow that model. So it saves us money. We're just giving our board and these investors and Skoll and some others the same reporting on these outcomes so that we're all seeing the same inside information. And then finally, Paul Collins, who runs our work in California, is over here. So I just wanted to say hi, Paul, and thanks.
Okay, great. So now I'm going to go in back so I can see this side of the room. So we're going to open it up for questions. And again, do we have one or two mics, L'Oreal? Two mics. Okay, great. So if you have some questions, just raise your hand. And we'll get a mic to you. Any questions? Oh, right.
Hi, I used to be a nonprofit CFO, and I still wear that hat as a consultant. So I was really excited to hear Esther talk about tracking cost per outcome. And I think that's really important to be able to use evaluation to make good decisions about allocating scarce resources. And I'm wondering if you or any of the other panelists can comment on what's being done in that area.
Sure. This is something that we are actually in the process of rethinking about. And I appreciated Mark's comment earlier about contribution versus attribution, because I think our initial efforts with SROI was, in fact, we were trying to figure out what does it cost to achieve that particular outcome. But then we had done it from the perspective of what is the cost savings to society? What does the public save by having a person be in a social enterprise versus in some other intervention or status quo, nothing happens to them at all? I think we're rethinking about it now and saying, well, from a more general cost-benefit approach, so what was the intervention? And not really caring so much about what percentage of it was REDA funded although maybe we could calculate that, but it's more important to say, what is social enterprise as an approach, and sort of deconstruct that a little bit and say, okay, for at-risk youth, this particular social enterprise invested in this kind of case management, 8 hours of support a month, other than 20 hours a week of employment, and it was for a year, plus this education, and then some job placement and support after that. So just quantifying what is the total cost of that as a start. And we think that the new software that we're investing in for our portfolio, one of the things we liked about it was the fact that it, at the each user level, actually tracks both those inputs as well as the outcomes. And so what we'd like to do long term is to see, okay, well, what does the intervention actually look like, and then put a cost against that, and then compare it to how other people are looking at costs, which we found is pretty variable.
Great.
Yeah, please.
I think that, well, you may have heard Muhammad Yunus, Bill Drayton talking about, you know, could there ever be a day when we had a social change stock market, you know, something where you could really have a competitive market around achieving social good? And the biggest challenge to that is, how could you get the sort of transparency around outcome and expense data that we see in the for-profit markets? There is a very interesting opportunity in that regard in the college access space. I mentioned that National Student Clearinghouse database. So college access is a much, I think, simpler field than what mm-hmm. you're describing. Like, there's kind of one big outcome, and it's college enrollment rate. And the data is in registrars' offices all over the country, and now there's a database that has all that information. So you have the potential here. I think there's an opportunity for some people to come together to actually create a bit of an outcomes per dollar marketplace in college access, because it's a simple outcome and the infrastructure's there. So I think that's a very interesting opportunity. And then I would say, just in general, I think Google and Microsoft and some others have done some work here in California around getting data from the state K-12 system to be readily available. I think the work on the part of foundations and others to figure out how in some other fields to get publicly available, you know, inexpensive evaluation data available can be transformative for different fields.
Yeah, I'll just make a comment on that, because as I mentioned before, so I was a grantee in the early days of social return on investment. And was recognized for getting in yelling fights with Rediff at the time. And I do think, you know, the point that I always said is garbage in, garbage out. And to the extent when you have a complex intervention, is it correlation or causation? And there was no causation. It was too expensive to do that. And so I think there was a mistake in that particular field trying to move on that social return on investment that was coming out of the Valley and really driven from VCs and so forth. It wasn't the people on the ground saying, this is the best use of my resources. I'm not saying it can't. There may be some subsets that it's valuable. I think it's valuable to be able to compare what is a better intervention and are there costs that go with it. But I think I'm a little bit skeptical about this, you know, social capital market. I think it sounds good, but oftentimes the devil is in the detail. So I just kind of a little word of caution around that. So more questions. Why don't we go right here, and then we'll head this way next.
Question is also for Esther. I represent a foundation, and foundations have too often, in my opinion, you know, funded for 3 years and then moved on to another group. And I noticed that you worked 10 years with one group of organizations.
Yes.
And decided to change your evaluation process and moved on to a different group. Why didn't you stay with the same group with a new format or new matrices for evaluation?
So the change happened before the change in evaluation approach. It was really driven by internal strategic planning process where we looked at the marketplace of other social enterprises, other groups, and other opportunities and thought, well, you know what? The groups that we've been working with for the past 10 years are now much more mature than they were when we started with them. And so sort of from our investment purposes, we thought we could have greater impact with the same resources that we were applying with other groups. So helping earlier stage organizations to build social enterprises, to employ more people. So that's why we made this strategic decision to work with a new set of organizations. It was basically because we felt like our portfolio was already successful. Then we thought that this was a golden opportunity with a new group because they hadn't been, you know, spending 10 years with us with an old measurement approach, that this was a great opportunity to actually try something different based on what we've learned.
Great. Okay, and I know that I saw some questions over here.
It seems that using evaluation, baking evaluation into the DNA of the organization and working a little bit on the grantee side to find measures that are meaningful to the grantees is effective and is an interesting approach, and that's kind of come out in what you said, JB, and also you, Sandy. And I wonder whether there's been any experience on any of your parts to take it to the next level and really work with the clients themselves and to work with them on their own life plans or their own, you know, performance measures to see how things are going.
In terms of ours, I think there is an analogous process that goes on. I don't know that we think of it in terms of evaluation, simply because that word has some connotations around it that maybe we wouldn't want to bring with families. But certainly in doing the service planning with families and having goals, I mean, it's essentially, you know, basically a service plan ends up being sort of a logic model. Where you have your desired results, you have the activities that are going to lead to it, you have your inputs that you need to do to take care of it, you have your outputs, your indicators of how well you're doing and what's happening, and then you're looking to see if you're finally getting to your goal. So we do in that sense, and that was one of the ways the case managers actually incorporated their thinking about evaluation and working with the people that came out from Jamie's staff who actually worked directly with families and case managers. So I'm not sure if that's where you're going, but we do incorporate that thinking.
And then do clients take that and sort of think about how that might enhance their employability or help them achieve things that they would like to do?
There are evaluations that we have done within our shop where we engage the clients at different levels. This one, it was kind of a matter of scale and timing, and it was on our discussion table but didn't really take off. But a couple things I think that we did do relate to what you're asking. We had a feedback loop with the families who were interviewed as well. So when we had these big reports coming out, we tried a few different formats, and we gave them their data, not their individual data back, but that family level data, so that they could see what they had contributed to and kind of hear how some of the agencies or the initiative was using what they had provided as a group. So we had the feedback loop with them. And then we had some questions in our interviews that I hadn't thought about this at the time, but almost created that internal marking for them. So we would ask them early on what a few of their goals were that they'd hoped to achieve, what, you know, three things that they'd hoped their children would achieve in the transitional housing. And then we took those and asked about them at the follow-up time point. So my interviewers would say, you know, you had talked about these three things. Where do you feel like you are at in achieving those? Where are your children at now compared to where you wanted them to be? So kind of built it in. I would have loved to have a client group to sit down and talk about results in a more formal way, but just that's one piece that didn't happen for us this time.
Great. So I think we've got time for probably two more questions. So got one here, and you'll get the last one there.
Thank you. I'm working with a group of nonprofits who are saying that the cost of data collection for all the various entities that they have to respond to is tremendous and overburdening them, just in terms of demographics that measure it differently. So you have different governments who want different. How did you, or did you even bring into this discussion the government funders, and were they able to satisfy the people in Washington, in our case the people in Sacramento as well as the local, to agree to at least demographics to make it simpler for everyone?
Homeless management information system is still getting off the ground, and it had started 7 years ago when we were designing ours. So what we did, you know, we looked at what they were asking. That's where involving the case managers in the data collection instrument design was critical, because we just said, how are you asking these questions about, you know, race and family constellation and all? So what are you already collecting? What do you already have to report? And we were working across three counties, so there were differences, but we tried our best to make our questions simple and straightforward enough and to match a lot of the categories and ways that families were already being counted. But the way that the government entities were moving and the speed with which we needed to move were just completely different timescales, unfortunately.
Although I will say we were fortunate in our county. There was a three-county region, so it wasn't necessarily true in the other two, but within the county that we work in, there had been kind of simultaneously to all this happening an interest in outcome alignment and having city, county, and United Way, which is a major funder in our area, align their at least demographic questions so that they were asking the same categories, and you could have your database built so that it could respond to any of those. And then when you came along, you were helpful in terms of still pulling that together and not adding, you know, a different category that no one had ever heard of or had. So,
and also in terms of easing the burden, we didn't ask questions that we knew we wouldn't use the information for from the case managers. And we had really easy to use online instrumentation, and all of the interviewing passed the intake. Case managers completed the intake because it was so much like the intake instruments that were being used in many agencies already. But my staff did all the interviewing of families from that point on. So we did where we could. We pulled the weight of the work onto our team.
Okay, and I think it was one last question there.
Yeah, this is a question for JB. Do you track college graduation rates, and are you able to find any data that correlates number of remedial courses that students need when they're going in? Underrepresented groups often have higher remediation needs going into college and college graduation rates, and also, do you look at attitudes about college and the relationship between actually enrolling in a four-year college and the attitudes of the students going in or even through high school, what difference that makes?
Thanks. The database that we draw from tracks college persistence and graduation. So we are able, for 6 years, so we're able to track graduation rates. We're able to track two-year versus four-year. It does not. It doesn't survey the particular courses that the students take, and nor attitudinal. So it's a very powerful tool because it basically allows us to evaluate every student every year. But it has a fairly high level of data, which is, are they enrolled in what institution, and do they stay there, and do they graduate?
So great. So I think, like I mentioned at the beginning, you know, we have these diverse examples here, but obviously there's some key underpinnings, whether they're talking about performance management and learning. I think they've all spoken to how important it is to make this part of the learning culture of your organization, to be getting that timely feedback, whether you call it your leading indicators or another term. So you're making these improvements. And again, I think how Jamie, you know, referred to also, things are going to change. You're going to design your evaluation and you get 3 months in and, oh, this was what we really should be tracking. So I think whether you're the funders out there, consultants or so forth, there's some real lessons learned we have here. And one of the things that I think came up as we, A, kind of looked to the future, two things kind of stood out to me. One is this idea of how do we engage more the clients in the evaluation and the data, and is that newsletters to the clients? Again, it doesn't necessarily have to be specific, but again, whether it's be collecting it or engaging them in a more proactive, comprehensive way, I think we're starting to see some models out there, so that'll be interesting to see how that evolves. And then the last comment, and I don't think we have an answer, but again, Mark's point being at a business school, one of the things that still kind of baffles me is the complexity of everybody building their own. And so, you know, from a model standpoint, you know, and hopefully we'll see with Esther kind of taking an off-the-shelf evaluation, can you tailor that to be successful? So to really reduce the cost across these organizations. And so whether the business people are in the room, I think there's a market opportunity there if you can do that effectively, because again, building these databases and evaluation tools over time is enormously expensive. Thank you to the panelists.
You've been listening to a presentation from Stanford Social Innovation Review. Stanford Social Innovation Review provides leaders in the nonprofit, government, and business sectors with the ideas, tools, and skills needed to solve social problems. For more information, visit us online at ssireview.org.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was George Hawthorne. Our website editor was Marguerite Rigoglioso. The series producer is Bernadette Clavier.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nie on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.